So we shall continue our study of the Katha Upanishad. 1.3.3. Now this is the chariot. Atmanam ratinam vidhi shariram ratam evatu buddhintu saratim vidhi manah pragraham evachak. So Atmanam, the self, Ratinam, self as the master of the chariot. Imagine the analogy is of a chariot. Know the individual self, that is the Atman. Now the word Atman, when used in the Upanishads, does not necessarily mean the infinite and the eternal. It's used for both. And sometimes it's used to just describe even the body. Sometimes it's used to describe the mind. Sometimes the self, the small self, the big, and then also as the infinite and eternal reality. Now in this case, it's the individual self imagining our journey through life. What is that journey like? Atmanam ratinam vidhi. Vidhi, know that the Atman is the master of the chariot. Ratha is the chariot. So know the Atman to be the master of the chariot, that is, this entity, whatever you call yourself. And the body, shariram ratham eva, the sharira, the body is the vehicle that the Atman is guiding. And then know that the intellect is the charioteer and the mind is the reins. So using that as an analogy, they call the senses the horses, the senses having been imagined as horses. Know the objects, the sense objects, as the roads. The discriminating people call the self the enjoyer when it is associated with the body, the senses, and the mind. So this is the image. This is our life. We're, this body is our chariot, which we're navigating through the highways and byways of existence. And the senses are the horses that pull the chariot along. That's how we move through life. We have our senses tell us that something is necessary, and our mind tells us something is necessary, and we guide the vehicle of our own body accordingly. They call the senses the horses. The objects are the roads. Discriminating people call the self the enjoyer when it is associated with the body, the senses, and the mind. So this is majestically we're moving on through existence in this chariot. But the senses of that intellect, which being ever associated with an uncontrolled mind, becomes devoid of discrimination. These are like a chariot drawn by unruly horses, vicious horses, dushtaswa. So if the intellect is devoid of discrimination, if the mind is uncontrolled and the intellect is devoid of discrimination, then the chariot goes out of control. But that intellect, which being ever associated with a restrained mind, is endowed with discrimination. The senses are controllable like the good horses of the charioteer. But he, the master of the chariot, does not attain that goal who, being associated with a non-discriminating intellect and an uncontrolled mind, is ever impure. He only attains samsara. Samsara is a word we use all the time, but it actually comes from this Upanishad. Tat padamapnoti samsaram chadhigacchati. So he attains samsara. Samsara is samsur. Sur is to move, the root, to move, and samsara is the prefix sam is used sometimes as an intensive, but in this case it means going round and round, moving round and round. This is our samsara, going around and around, and never ever moving, never attaining. So this imagery is, if you're in a chariot, you have the horses, it's your job to control the horses. The chariot is going to move in any case, but it's your job to make sure it goes where you want it to go. And in this case, there's no friendly, I don't know, in California we call it the highway patrol. In this case, there's no friendly policeman that will gently come up in back of you with a flashing red light and telling you and very sweetly that you have exceeded the speed limit and you have been driving recklessly and this and that. That doesn't really happen like that. It's not that easy. When the chariot goes out of control, everything begins to fall to pieces. Anyway, this is the analogy. So our life has to be controlled. And that's something that many people don't really appreciate. No, I should do what I feel like doing. I feel like this. I have an inner urge to do this. That's all right. But there are consequences for all these things. So life has to become disciplined. A life that is not disciplined, that is not controlled, is likely to go astray. Like a chariot, the horses of a chariot that are not controlled. And by the way, there's an interesting thing about horses and chariots. When you, a horse, how do you know how horses are controlled? You may not know. But horses are very sensitive in their mouths. On the side of the mouth, there's great sensitivity. For some reason, I don't know, they're constructed that way. Horses are built that way. So there's charioteer puts a piece of steel here in his mouth. And he can control the by the reins, by pulling the steel in one direction. I mean, he doesn't hurt the horse, but I mean, he gives a strong pressure in one direction and the horse goes that way. He's trained that way. He goes the pressure in another direction, the horse goes the other way. But there comes a time when, as they say, the horse takes the bit in his teeth. There's that expression. If the bit is not placed just right and it gets loose, the horse can get this his teeth under the bit, and so that when you're pulling back on the reins, you're actually not pulling against the sensitive parts of his mouth, but you're pulling against the teeth, and the horse doesn't care. So you can pull whichever way you want. The horse will go its own way anyhow. So taking the bit in his teeth like that. So, in other words, there's a skill involved. Yoga karma sukaushalam. As Sri Krishna says in the Gita, it's dexterity in action is what is called yoga. He has many definitions of yoga. That's one of the definitions. Karma sukaushalam, dexterity in action, knowing how to do things. Knowing, first of all, one important thing we have to know is we have to be realistic about our own selves. We know deeply, we know what is right with us, and we also know what is wrong with us. We know where we're going to, you know, where we're pretty reliable and we can be expected to do very well. And we also know where we're likely to wander and wobble and get off the beaten path. So that skill in maneuvering this chariot of our life is extremely crucial. First of all, this the old Greek saying was "know thyself." It's probably attributed to Socrates. Know thyself. Know your own self. Realize and admit and examine and search out your own being, your own reality. Where, what is it? Are you? What are you sensitive to? What are the areas of danger in your life? We all have that. We all come that way. We come equipped from previous existences with areas, with sharp areas in our own behavior, in our own being. So we have to know that, and we have to also know how we can control that. And that takes that is not something that can be automatically done. It takes skill to control these, to control our own nature, to control our own impulses, to be, Shakespeare said, to thine own self be true, and thou canst not then be false to any man. Be true to yourself. That is our, the obligation that's put on all of us. But try to find out what is the, what is, don't have any false image of our own capabilities, our own understanding, our own propensities, the pressures under which we are likely to move in odd directions. We should know that, not in a pessimistic way, but in a very realistic, scientific way. We should know where we're likely to weaken and where we're likely to wobble in our path. And then figure out some way to counter those things. How to do that? How to face the challenges of life? How to face the quirks that our own nature will expose us to? And first of all, admit that. See it in an objective way. This is not in a morbid sense. This is in a very realistic sense. Where is it that, I mean, like you examine an automobile, you know, where, okay, this is a great car, but it has 150,000 miles on it, and by now there may be certain things that are not right about it. So you impassionately, imperturbably, I should say, look at it and examine what is right about it and what is wrong, and then take measures, practical measures, to counter the wrong. So this is dealing with the horses in a creative way. And we have many techniques at our disposal, and the one that works unfailingly is surrender to God. Unfailingly. I mean, you say, well, I don't know, is it, you know, is it going to help me, is it not going to help me? They say surrender to God, but you know, well, chant the name of the Lord, but pass the ammunition. You know, keep your powder dry. All these things are there. Okay, keep your powder dry, pass the ammunition, but then rely on God anyhow. That is the sum of it. Why is it that these horses of our life, when they encounter problems, that reliance on God, why is that so effective? First of all, if you have made God the center of life, the purpose of existence, the goal to attain, God means any spiritual goal. We've made that the purpose, the center of our life. Then, not only in a general way or in a superficial way, we have to take refuge in something spiritual. Yes.
Reliance is not there. How do we increase this reliance on God?
Well, there are several ways that I mentioned. One is to have, I mean, spiritual, if you want to enter a spiritual life, that cannot be done without the guidance of some spiritual teacher. Now, in the beginning, that spiritual teacher will probably be books and maybe some advice from this person and that person, some spiritual guidance. But sooner or later, we have to make up our mind. What path are we going to follow? We can't go from one inspiration to another indefinitely. At some point, we have to choose a way. This is the way that I'm going to follow. I believe that this way is going to get me to the goal of spiritual insight. I want spiritual insight. I want to experience the presence of that spiritual reality. It can be personal or impersonal. I want spiritual experience, but I don't know how to get it, so I have to go to a teacher. I mean, even if you are, whoever, I think Sri Ramakrishna said, even if you want to learn how to steal, you have to go to a teacher, you see. And if you want to get a degree in anything, you have to go to teachers. You go to a school, you get a thesis and you get a thesis advisor and you put your reliance in the thesis advisor. You don't, you don't go at random, just exactly the way you want. The thesis advisor tells you, no, you have to do this, because then you have to do it. I mean, the thing is there. You have to admit, first of all, that you don't know everything. That is the first requirement. It seems easy, and on the surface it is easy, but actually it's not. Because deep down inside we do feel that we have the capability of going it alone and doing everything exactly the way we want, and we'll get to the goal. But that may happen. It did happen in the beginning to Sri Ramakrishna. He had the vision of the Divine Mother without any real help. There was an initiation in the Shakti Mantra by a teacher, but he didn't really have any real inspiration. He went on his own, and he was able to attain the vision of God through his own effort. But you can imagine his qualifications and then compare them to our qualifications. And then you see, well, yeah, he managed to do it, but even after he did it, he felt unsure that this was really all that there was to it. That is the point. You may reach the goal, but you know that that's the goal. You know that's the end of it. Afterwards, he took spiritual teachers and he followed their instructions, Bhairavi Brahmani and Todapuri, and he followed their instructions. Of course, he reached everything he had to reach in an incredible hurry, and they were all amazed at how quickly he did it. But that was the reason they said that he did it, was to be convinced. You know, he had realized these things, but is this all there is to it? Have I really reached the goal? Have I reached the end? And so that was his case. Our case is much more common. And so the point is, you have to make some choice somewhere. And nobody is pressuring you. There's no hurry to do it. But somewhere, if you want to realize God, you have to decide you're going to travel some path or other. And then once you decide the path that is suitable for you, then you choose a teacher who is going to be able to instruct you in following that path. So you make a decision, you make a commitment, you decide this is the way I'm going to follow. You're not going to change it tomorrow. Oh yeah, hey, there's this great teacher I've heard about. I think I'll go to him or her. I mean, once you may go to all sorts of teachers, but they're your reliance is placed on the one you've chosen as your primary source of inspiration and guidance. And that person will instruct you in, okay, the path that we are prescribing is like this. And so you make a commitment that way. And whatever that path is, and usually it's called Ishta Devata, it's a chosen ideal. You choose an ideal and then you practice according to what is customary for that particular discipline. And then that ideal is the ideal for you. In other words, that is the, you don't see God, but you see, you use that ideal as representation of God. This is God for you. So in other words, you've concentrated your attention on something specific. Then your reliance is on that, your surrender is on that, your attention is on that, your dedication towards attaining spiritual insight is through that. And that itself will in time become living. The Ishta, as you meditate on your chosen ideal, your chosen form of spiritual fulfillment, becomes living for us. And also becomes our help. Swami Vivekananda said, think of God in only one way, as an eternal help. So that we get help from that. If we try to do it all ourselves, it's only the most extraordinary cases can you say that that would have a chance of success. So when we surrender to that idea, we say, okay, this is my ideal. This is how I want to realize God. This is the essence of truth. As a symbolic essence of truth, it may be right now, but it is, for me, it is the goal. It is the way. And there is, if there's a reality to it, it will answer. It will help. It will become a source of inspiration. It will become a source of guidance. And it will do remarkable things. It'll become a source of sweetness in life, in meditation, in everything. This is what we rely on. So how to get, the whole question is how to get these horses controlled, this chariot, and control the horses. I mean, whatever you can do on your own without that, that's fine, great, but there'll come a point where we can't go beyond. You know, we're just not, there's too much uncertainty, there's too much confusion, there's too much lack of knowledge on our part. So like this, going a specific route and then relying, surrendering to a specific spiritual ideal, making that the end of everything. And then we find that we get everything from that. That is the miracle of it. The miracle, the amazing miracle of it, that is that it actually works. But you have to work at it. You have to try it. You have to dedicate yourself to it. It's not something you can just do, you know, at random, just sort of casually. No, you have to give your whole attention to it, your whole life to it. That doesn't mean that you, feel in any way negatively about other ways of doing things, of other spiritual ideals. No, but this is your path, you know, and this is where you should go. Swamiji wrote a poem called The Cup. And he said, this is your cup. It was probably filled with some noxious brew, you see. He said, this is your cup. You know, it has there's no particular glory in it, but this is your cup. This is your way. And take it and drink it. this path is meant for you. There's no particular glory, no particular tremendous grace, but it's meant for you. It's not meant for anybody else, and it's going to work for you. If you want something flashy and very tremendously attractive and full of glory and with bells and whistles, well, that it may not be. It may be a very plain cup with a very rather dark brew in it, but it's meant for you and it'll do the job. So, but that is how to control this chariot, how to get to the goal. Somewhere you have to make that decision, you have to do something specific. You can't just be in general, yes, I'm in favor of God. I think it's a good idea, but that's not good enough. It's not good enough. There has to be something very specific. I mean, if you wanted to learn nuclear physics, you wouldn't just go at random like that. You'd go to a person who was practicing scientist in nuclear physics, and that's how you would learn it. You wouldn't just say, well, I'm going to read a few books here and then I'll know all about it. No, that isn't the way it happens. And it doesn't happen that way in spiritual life either. Remember, you can always object, and questions and all that, always welcome. Okay, so this is the chariot. And the senses of that intellect, which, being ever associated with an uncontrolled mind, becomes devoid of discrimination and are like the unruly, like the vicious horses of a charioteer. But that intellect, which, being ever associated with a restrained mind, is endowed with discrimination, for that the senses are controllable like the good horses of a charioteer. That person, however, who has as his charioteer a discriminating intellect and who has under control the reins of the mind attains the end of the road, and that is the highest place of Vishnu. Tad Vishnu Paramam Padam. He attains the goal of Vishnu. Vishnu being the all-pervading reality. And then it goes into a different discussion. Indriyebhyah parahyartha atebhyascha paramanaha. There's a gradation. The sense objects are higher than the senses, and the mind is higher than the sense objects. Now, the sense objects are higher than the senses. The actual psychological fact that is being referred to here is, why are the sense objects higher than the senses? It's because the sense objects create the senses. The fact that there are sense objects brings about the fact that we have senses to enjoy these objects. That is one of the psychological truths, psychological realities. That because there are sense objects, we have senses to enjoy them. But the sense objects are then in control of the senses, so the sense objects are higher than the senses.
How can that be when everything originates from within? So how can that be higher than the senses?
Because it creates the senses. In other words, it's a fact. This is the view of this Upanishad. I mean, scientifically, you could say, well, maybe it's not like that. You look at it in a different way. But psychologically, this is the way it is. It's not, if you want to talk about it scientifically, you've got the senses and the sense objects, which came first. It seems like it's an unanswerable question. You just find there are sense objects and there are senses. But why are there senses to enjoy the sense objects? We have, the psychology of it is, we are the pure and the infinite and the eternal. We don't need the sense objects. We have no need of anything in this whole universe. This whole universe could simply crumble into dust tomorrow. There would be nothing. I mean, none of mine would be. Nothing of mine would be hurt. There was this famous story of King Janaka. He was the king of Mithila, and he was instructing some brahmacharis in the Vedas. And the brahmacharis, of course, had nothing. They were students. They simply lived with Janaka, the teacher, and he was teaching them the Vedas, teaching them spirituality somewhere outside his palace. And someone came to him and said, "Oh, the palace is burning. The palace is on fire." That was very nearby. You see, now the Janaka sat there unperturbed, but the brahmacharis rushed to the line where they had their chadars hanging and to save their clothes from in case the fire came this way. The king of Mithila, Janaka, whose whole empire was his, sat there completely unperturbed, and he said those famous lines, "Mithilayam pradeeptayam." If the whole of Mithila is burned to ashes, name kinchid pradahyate, nothing of mine is burnt. So this whole universe, this is the attitude we should have, the basic attitude. I'm not talking about being hard-hearted or insensitive to the needs of others. But at the very bottom of our consciousness, the very root upon which our thought stands, there should be this, something like this verse. Mithilayam pradeeptayam name kinchit pradakhyate. If the whole of Mithila were burned, the whole of my, all of my possessions and all of my whatever treasures and needs and whatever I have, if the whole of that, if this whole universe were to vanish from my sight this very moment, nothing of mine would be lost. Because I am not, in my true nature, I am not connected with any of this. I am the Atman. That basic knowledge has to be at the foundation of all our thought. This is the thing that, unless we have that, I mean, that is really living Vedanta, you see, that we take care of everything that we have, all of our possessions, all of our responsibilities, all of our projects and activities in this world. We take care of them very carefully and with great intensity and dedication. But it could please this universe that suddenly it crushes me to smithereens. My body goes in a second. Everything that I have might go in a second. I have to be convinced at the bottom of all of my thought, the foundation of all my life and my understanding and my striving has to be the fact that really I don't need anything. Nothing of mine is lost, even if all of this simply vanishes. Of course, I will work with great intensity to keep it from vanishing and do all that I need to do. But unless I have unless the very foundation of my life is built upon this, I am not following the essence of Vedanta, which I am the Atman. That is the only thing that will, that, and that is the foundation of this whole universe. So my life's foundation is never endangered in any way. Now, it's true, I may be trying to do this and do that and accomplish this and accomplish that, and I'll do everything to protect it, and I'll do all those things. But my fundamental attitude is that God alone exists. And because I love God, And God is lovable, God is sweetness, God is purity and joy, I will take care of his property in the very best way that I can. But the essence of God is not at all affected by what happens to on this plane. That has to be the very center of my being. Then I can be at peace. See, otherwise that fundamental, I can never attain that fundamental peace if I'm dependent on anything else. So, and this is this is what we are getting to here, that the sense objects are higher than sense. Oh, so in that sense, it's the objects that create, because I can perceive objects, because I perceive objects, I have a desire to deal with those objects. You say, well, I never did. I suddenly was born and I had these senses and I smelled this and I tasted this and I felt this and I saw this. It all came to me. But the psychology of it is, what the Upanishad is talking about is the psychology of it is that the sense objects create the senses. The senses, we create the senses in order to enjoy sense objects. That is the psychology of it. So the sense objects are higher than the senses. The mind is higher than the sense objects. Because the mind controls the sense objects, or should. The mind, we talk about a chariot, and the mind was the reins, was controlling the chariot. But the intellect is higher than the mind, because the intellect has a broader viewpoint, has the breadth of the purview of the intellect is higher than, it is the deciding faculty, the determining faculty. It guides the mind. It is the inner sense. And the great soul is higher than the intellect. Now, the great soul, Mahan Atma, Shankara's commentary is, it is the Atma, that is, it is the soul and the self, because it is the innermost principle of all the intelligence of all beings. And it is Mahan, great, because it is the most pervasive of all. The principle called Hiranyagarbha, which was born before all from the unmanifested, which consists of both intelligence and activity, is called the great soul. That is para, higher than the intellect. So this is now going the other way. Suppose you imagine the infinite Brahman. How does this duality arise in the infinite Brahman? It cannot. There is no second. This is what I was going to read from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad discussion between Yajnavalkya and Gargi. He said, the knowers of Brahman say that it is the immutable Brahman that is the ultimate reality. It's been a long conversation, but anyway, ultimate reality. It is neither gross nor minute, neither short nor long, neither red in color nor oiliness, neither shadow nor darkness, neither air nor ether, unattached, neither savor nor odor, without eyes or ears, without vocal organ or mind, non-luminous, without the vital force or mouth. It does not have any measure. It is without interior and exterior. It does not eat anything, nor is it eaten by anybody. This is the Supreme Brahman. This is the ultimate state, the original state, actually the present state of the universe. Under the mighty rule of this immutable, O Gargi, the sun and the moon are held in their positions. Under the mighty rule of this immutable, O Gargi, heaven and earth maintain their positions, etc., etc.
Ah. Where does
everything come
from?
Where does what?
It's formless and it has no qualities. Where does all the other stuff come from?
Wonderful. We're getting to that. Very good. That's exactly what we're getting to. This immutable, O Gargi, let me finish. I'm building this up, you see. I'm trying to make it very dramatic. I'm building this up. This immutable oligarchy is never seen, but is the witness. It is never heard, but is the hearer. It is never thought, but is the thinker. It is never known, but is the knower. There is no other witness but this. There is no other hearer but this. There is no other thinker but this. No other knower but this. By this immutable oligarchy is everything pervaded. And then he later on he says, it is not that the sense of seeing coming from the present universe, it is not that the sense of seeing in that ultimate state of Brahman, it is not that the sense of seeing is lost, but there is no second thing which it could see. It is not that the sense of hearing is lost. In other words, the potentially, the reality is still there, but there's no other reality that it could take note of. What the Upanishad is trying to describe is this totally indescribable reality, which we call Brahman. But, I mean, of all the descriptions in this Upanishad are just unmatched. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, how to describe that which no human language can possibly describe. It is beyond everything. Now, the question which you have asked is, how did all of this multiplicity come about if this is the reality of things? Of course, there's one purely scientific explanation which only physicists will understand. But there's a great truth in it. It's not really a joke. The great truth in it, and in a sense, physics may be expressing something, giving us some light on the inexpressible in that sense. Because there is a concept in physics called the uncertainty principle, which basically, in a very, very superficial way, says that two variables among definite pairs of variables, but they cannot both be measured to arbitrary accuracy at the same time. For instance, position and momentum. Now, you don't know what momentum is. But anyway, there are two variables, time and energy. Two variables that cannot be measured to arbitrary accuracy at the same time. There's some uncertainty. There's a minimum uncertainty. You cannot be absolutely certain about anything, is what it actually says. You cannot be absolutely certain about anything and at the same time be equally certain about something else. So there are pairs of variables, time and energy. If you know the time at which anything happened very, very precisely, exactly, you will not know the energy involved at all. And if you know the energy that was released during this process precisely, of course you can't ever know anything precisely, but if you could know it precisely, you would not know at all anything about the time at which it occurred. So, we say this, if in a time delta t, not zero, just some time interval, during that time, spontaneously, a little bit of a twitch took place in this universe and released an amount delta e of energy, that would be allowed by the laws of physics. So if you had total uniformity, they would say that this non-uniformity could, there would be a provision that in total uniformity, everything was Brahman, everything is there is no second, there is no multiplicity. In a small amount of time, a tiny interval of time, a little twitch in this energy could appear. And as soon as you've got that, aha, the whole universe is created. Now you say, well, that's all foolishness. That's all, you know, some scientific gobbledygook. Let's put it this way. We ain't got anything else. You cannot, there is no way of getting the many out of the one. In other words, this is the basis of the idea that this multiplicity that we seem to perceive is a partial interpretation of what actually the perception is. Really, there is only Brahman here. But we see it as many, and how did that happen? They trace it back. When you trace it back from the gross elements to the subtle elements to the mind to this and that, some universal principles, Hiranyagarbha and Mahat and all of that, there's a whole chain from one thing getting another, causing another to arise. But at the very beginning, how did that first one appear? That's what you're asking. How did that first non-uniformity, that first manifestation appear in the unmanifested, in the infinite, in the eternal, in the ever, in which there's no sense of duality whatsoever? How did that first twitch of duality appear? Nobody can say, because there's it's a question without an answer. But suffice it to say that in a little instant of time, a little bit of a twitch appeared in this infinite and eternal. And that is called Hiranyagarbha. It's the golden egg from which everything came. It has different names. Mahat, the great principle. And then some people say one thing came from another. But anyway, somewhere in this infinite reality, if we take it psychologically, in our own consciousness, which is infinite, eternal, is not, there's no second, a little bit of a second, a little bit of, imagine the infinite sky, gray sky clouds, just let's say a fog, and then a little bit of a wisp of smoke or something appears in that fog. That's all you need. From that, everything begins to grow. So this is traditional Vedantic cosmology. You just go back and back from the gross elements like this to the subtle elements, which is the mind and the mental, the world of ideas, as Swami Sarananda calls it. This world of gross forms is underlain by a world of ideas. And then Sri Ramakrishna was commanded by the Divine Mother, remain in Bhava Mukha. So what is the explanation? What is this Bhava Mukha? And Swami Sarananda gives a detailed explanation of what that is, but it's the source. You could say it's the region where this duality comes from. It's the source, and figuratively speaking, a person can stand at that junction and have a view of the infinite and the eternal, non-dual, and also have a view of this dual realm. You say that's impossible. If you have a view of the infinite and the eternal, how could you possibly, could there be anything else? Now, logically speaking, it couldn't happen. But nevertheless, there is such a thing. Remain in Bhava Mukha. Sri Ramakrishna was told there is such a thing. At the boundary of the realm of forms. Another thing in that same category is Sri Ramakrishna had the vision of, the idea of Swamiji's existence presented itself to him. His mind went up to the beyond this earthly sphere, and then to the realm of the gods, and there gods were sitting, and beyond that realm to the realm of ideas, and then there was a line between the realm of the formed and the formless. Now, how could there be a line on the edge of the realm of the formless? If you ask too many questions, your head will fall off. You know, this is what Yajnavalkya told during that meeting of scholars. There are certain things, if you go ask too far, your head will fall off, which means you will lose your balance, your mental balance. Of course, he literally, one person asked too much, his head did fall off and fell into some bushes, and robbers took it and took it away, thinking it was something else. You see, that's the humor of the Radharani Upanishad. Anyway, this is, you know, this is this realm he saw as he, as mind went up. There was a line between the realm of the formed and the realm of the formless. He jumped across that line, and then in the realm of the formless, he saw forms. He saw these seven sages who were in the realm of the formless, and they were absorbed in eternal meditation. And he went to the chief of these sages, who looked like the most absorbed and the most venerable of all, and that was Swamiji, and he begged him to come down. All right, but I mean, if you ask too many questions, it's the same thing. What does it mean to have a line at the edge of the, to dividing the realm of formlessness from the realm of form? You know, what is being said here is a very subtle thing. And if we try to bring it down to gross, you know, if we try to bring it down to the gross level, it's not going to give us any answer. We won't, you know, it'll just cause confusion. So what we have to do, what is being told us is something that is so subtle that there's no way of expressing it, but if there's no way of expressing it, we don't learn anything either. So for us to learn something, we have to say something about it. And then if you turn around and say, now, wait a minute, what do you mean by that? You're getting the wrong idea. What the message that is being given to us is a hint as to what is being talked about. We're at the very edge of communication. We're talking about something you can't communicate about, and yet we're demanding that something be said. So guaranteed that there are going to be contradictions, that you're not going to be able to, you know, if you try to follow the trail logically, it's not going to work, because what is being explained is something that is of such subtlety that you have to grasp the implication of it without submitting it to the ordinary detailed criticism. So he went to that realm of the formless, and he brought Swamiji down from the realm of the formless. You know, okay, we accept that. So in this same sense, we're in the same quandary here. How do you explain the existence of the many if the original truth is that infinite reality in which there is no second? Ekam eva dvitiyam brahma neha na nasti kinchana. Ekam advitiyam, ekam, that Brahman is one and it is without a second. Ekam eva advitiyam brahma neha nanasti kinchana. There is no multiplicity here. How do you understand that? There's no multiplicity here. There are not many. There are no two things here. There's no difference between you and anything else. There are no two things here. How do you understand that? That is the subtle, and that's why the Upanishad said this is seen only by the subtle seers using their subtle intellects. It's something that you have to meditate on. If you try to criticize it as though you would criticize a work of science, it's not going to work. It cannot be reached that way. Avang manasa gocharam, it is beyond mind and speech, it's beyond the range of mind and speech. But still we want to talk about it because it's the very, our own essence, it's our own reality. And we have only mind and speech to communicate, so we do, we use it. But if we think we can understand it that way, no, it's meant to, mind and speech are meant to impel us to try to realize it. It's only by realizing it that we'll have light and understanding on the subject. So this Upanishad then, when it talks about these, what is the greatest, this is greater than that, this is subtler than that, you come to a realm like that, just like that. What is the real? What is reality here? You start from gross objects to subtle objects, to subtler, subtler, subtler. You come to that same problem. But what it's trying to say is there is an end, and the end is here. He said the unmanifested is higher than Mahat. Purusha is higher than the unmanifested. There is nothing higher than Purusha. He is the culmination. He is the ultimate. He is the highest goal. Sa kashta paragatihi, the supreme goal. Kashta, the Shankara's commentary is, Purusha is kashta, the acme, the culmination of subtleness, greatness, and inwardness as self. Here indeed end all subtleness coming from the senses. Hence, this is paragatihi, the supreme goal of all travelers, all individual souls that transmigrate. Because the Smriti says, going where they do not return, and that unmanifest, which is called the imperishable, is said to be the supreme goal, attaining which they return not. That is my supreme abode. That supreme being, O Partha, in whom all beings and by whom, in whom are all beings, and by whom all this is pervaded, is attainable by one-pointed devotion. So when you mentally bring things back from the gross, this gross next level is the subtle, still subtler and subtler. There is an end to this process, and the end is called the Purusha. This is the unmanifested, the supreme. Paramam Gatim, this is, he also calls it Paramam Gatim. So those, Tad Dhamma Paramam Mama, that is my supreme abode. So there is an end to this process. So that is the end of this particular section. But then it goes on, continuing the Katha Upanishad. He is hidden in all beings, and hence he does not appear as the self. But by the seers of subtle intellect, subtle things, he is seen through a pointed and fine intellect. So it is something we can think about, and it's something we can aim at. It's something that we can approach. We can read. He is hidden in all beings. Esha sarveshu bhuteshu gudha. Atmana prakashate. This self that is hidden in all beings. He does not appear. He does not. He is not seen. He is seen through a pointed and fine intellect. In other words, these things that we're talking about, from the highest, the most subtle, to the grossest, the ladder between the two, the relationship of one thing to another, the whole establishment of the cosmos and how it comes, how it's related to the infinite and the eternal, all these things we cannot exactly say, but it can be experienced. In other words, I cannot explain Brahman, but I can realize myself to be Brahman, to be the Atman. These are things that I can realize. I may not be able to talk about it because we are getting beyond the range of speech. There's no way of actually explaining that and then answering questions about it. It's way too subtle for that. But it's something that I can experience. I can become that. I may not be able to explain it, I can become that. So this is to give an idea. The Upanishad is, that is the work of the Upanishads, to explain to us what, to try to, this is the glory of the Upanishads, to try to make clear to us in words that which is way beyond words, to inspire us to reach that beyond which there's nothing to reach, the ultimate, in which we have the feeling that everything that was to have been reached has been reached. And this is the glory of the Upanishad, that they have been able to come that close to make us, first of all, to inspire us by this, because we have no experience of it, so we need that inspiration. But they've been able for thousands of years to inspire people to achieve something beyond imagination, beyond explanation, beyond the possibility of precise definition. But they have been able to make it clear enough to motivate us for thousands of years to reach that. That is the glory of the Upanishads. And that is the Vedanta. That is our role as Vedantists or Vedantins. That is our role, to continue that tradition. This thing, I mean, where there's one tendency here, which is to say, okay, the Upanishads have expressed everything that can be expressed, so now this is, you know, we don't consider ourselves to be a chain, a link in a chain of any sort. But we are the people who have to transmit all of this. Unless this knowledge, this experience is transmitted by people who are struggling to attain it, it is, we're not following. We have an obligation. When we study Vedanta, we have an obligation. Vedanta doesn't claim to have achieved everything, but it claims that if you have a love for this, for the infinite, the eternal, the real, that which is beyond mind and speech, that is which is beyond want, that which is, you know, what the whole world dreams of but doesn't know how to reach, we have an obligation to carry that on. We have an obligation to, first of all, understand it ourselves, and you can't leave it to, you know, sannyasins and sannyasinis to do that. They will do what they can, but each one of us is responsible for this. Each one of us is a link in a chain. So the benefit that you have received from what the Upanishads have to teach, what the Gita has to teach, what the spiritual teachers have to teach, if we have been benefited by it, we have a very important obligation to continue that tradition, to realize it as much as we can ourselves, but even beyond the realization, to live that way. Our life should be lived with that spirit. And that itself, we don't have to say anything to anybody, that itself will pass these ideas along. These ideas should, of course, they will never completely vanish from the earth, but we have to do our effort, our best to make these things, to enliven these things. It's only when these ideas are actually being practiced, when people actually take them seriously and practice them in their own lives, and that is seen by others, and it is known that there are human beings who are devoted to this, that carries on the inspiration. And that is our obligation. If you find something great, you have to share it. Sri Ramakrishna said there are two kinds of people who eat mangoes, you know. One type eats the mango, oh, delicious, delicious, and then carefully washes their hands, wipes their mouth, and then appears in front of others as though nothing had happened. And then there's the other who said, these are great mangoes. Hey, won't you have some? And that's our obligation. It's not, you know, we tend to be a little selfish about this, that we want to reach the truth alone. But in addition to reaching the truth, we have that obligation to somehow witness by our presence, by our activities, by our just our being, that there is truth here, there is help here, there is hope here, there is a sense of importance here. It's our obligation to pass this on. That means every one of us. It's not, I'm just a learner in all of this process. Everyone is a learner. Sri Ramakrishna himself said he was a learner. As long as I live, so long do I learn. So we're in that sense, we're not at all disqualified. So these ideas, first of all, these ideas have to become factors in our own life. God exists. That's the first thing. God exists. We have to know that for sure. Brahman exists. The Atman exists. We have to know that. We have to be fully convinced of that. We have to strive for the realization of that. And the realization of little bits, you know, just a little taste of that is not that difficult. It's not beyond the range of our efforts at all. It's not something that is so far-fetched. It's beyond hope. No. Each one of us can become a little light. But that if there is any light at all in darkness, it doesn't matter how large it is, that light testifies to the existence of light. That darkness is, it's the darkness. Darkness has no reality. If you take light away, that is darkness. But darkness is only related to light. Darkness is nothing. But we seem to be overwhelmed by that. We think that darkness is something that is something substantial like an immovable obstacle. But just striking the tiniest of light will totally remove the darkness. Darkness is nothing. There's no reality to it. So the simplest experience we have of any, in any sense, of any little divine taste or inspiration or whatever you want to call it, that itself is a testimony to the existence of light, that this darkness is not real. And that we have, all of us have an obligation to do. Now we can have more questions. If you want questions, I'm not saying I have answers, but at least you'll have questions. That's good. Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, the emotions are, they're positive emotions and negative emotions. And, an experience of any kind, even a small experience of a divine presence, divine reality, can bring about, you know, wonderful emotions. And then also emotions can be very negative, very unfulfilling. Emotions, so there's a very positive aspect to emotions, and there's also a very negative aspect to it. And that, of course, that's always the case. Wherever there's anything, you can say something positive, there's also the negative side is also present. Emotions are wonderful and are necessary and can lead straight to God. But the thing is, they have to be, it's like, again, the well-regulated horses. It's something that has to be, emotions have to be controlled. Swami Vivekananda, after Sri Ramakrishna got ill, I think, while he was still at Kashipur, he found that people were faking these spiritual emotions. In fact, they were taking onions and putting onions, rubbing onions in order to bring about tears, you know, and these would be tears of devotion, and then they would have these trances and this and that, like the master used to have. So the emotions are, basically emotions are really speaking all that we have. Ideas are, don't move us much unless there is an emotion behind it. So, I mean, we may have a tremendous idea, but it's the emotion that gives it the energy to realize it, to become living. So the emotions can be constructive and destructive. But we work hard to try to develop spiritual emotions, because we're already very well acquainted with emotions in a negative sense, and so we're trying to base emotions on a spiritual foundation. It amounts to this: if the emotion is connected with the reality of a divine principle beyond mind and beyond the physical, beyond the mental, a spiritual reality, that emotion, you know, that we want to cultivate an emotion based on that. If it's based on our perceptions of this universe, then it should be, all emotions should be controlled, all emotions, I mean, even divine emotions, like we were saying, it can slip over into something negative easily. But the question is, what is our basic viewpoint? What is our basic understanding here? No matter what is our life based on? Our life, the message of Vedanta, the message of the Upanishads is life has to be based on the existence of the eternal. That has to be central to us. If it's central in our mind that God alone exists, everything else is a partial view of that divine reality. I'm seeing this world. If God did not exist, I would not see this world. I would not see anything if that infinite did not exist. So, and our emotions are based on this. So, The necessity for successful use of the emotions is to be convinced that divinity, God, the infinite, the eternal, is the only reality. Everything that I perceive is a partial perception of God. And this also becomes our spiritual practice. Every pratibodha viditam, from the Kena Upanishad, it is to be seen in every perception, every idea, every bit of knowledge is to be, the infinite and the eternal is to be seen at the heart of that. God is to be seen as at the heart of every perception. Or to put it another way, every perception is a perception of God. We think we're seeing people, we think we're seeing buildings and things, and we think we're being buffeted about by ideas and emotions. Actually, the only thing that's moving us, the only thing that's happening at all is entirely God, the infinite, the eternal. I'm misreading it, I'm partially reading it. Every person, every being, every situation, every moment of our life, God is the only thing we are ever experiencing. It's the only thing we're ever seeing. It's the only thing we're ever hearing or touching or knowing. God is the only reality. And the fact that I have put some other interpretation on it, no, I'm seeing things. Okay, here's a building, I need to build this building. Here's a person, my relative, my friend, and I need to communicate with them, deal with them, all the different activities of our life. Every single last activity of our life is a perception of God and nothing else. Every moment we see God and God alone, there is nothing else to be seen. That conviction has to be central to our thought, to our conception, to our ideas. It is God and God alone. And so my conscious and deliberate and total attempt has to be to see God in every perception. And of course, I'll forget it, and I'll deal with things as though they were ordinary, and I'll have emotions, and I deal with these emotions as though they were ordinary emotions. My emotions are really about God alone. And that sort of concept, I am totally surrounded by God every moment. There is nothing else in this universe. This whole universe itself is nothing but a partial perception of God. Every perception, in order to perceive anything, first you have to perceive God. First you have to know, you have to be conscious. Sat, existence. If your everything that you perceive is perceived because it has existence, it exists. And anything that exists is Sat, existence, which is infinite and eternal. There's no boundary. Where can you say existence stops somewhere? There's no limit. Where is existence not? People ask, where is God? The real question is, where is God not? So that has to be the very basis of our idea system. And if it's that, if that has to be embedded in us, that we have to make one with our very personality, our very being. There is nothing in this universe but God. Where is God? I can't find God anywhere. That means as soon as you say, I cannot find God, in all these respects, I'm only perceiving God. I cannot say those words without actually seeing God. So that sort of concept has to be at the very, I mean, that has to be the very foundation upon which the whole edifice of our mind and our striving is built. The infinite alone exists, Brahman alone exists. And then in that, you have the method of reaching, and you have not only we're reaching up to God, God is also reaching down to us, or I wouldn't say down, across to us. God is reaching to us and we're reaching to God because that is our very nature, that is our very reality. So then you choose an object, an ideal, a principle and an embodiment of divinity. So then we rely on that, and then Sri Ramakrishna has to get busy. Because, you know, we've relied on him or Jesus or Buddha or Krishna or Rama. Anyway, they have to get busy because the ball is in their court. And they, you know, they are the ones who are the accessible Brahman, the accessible reality. There we get our sweetness, there we get our joy, there we feel the presence. You see, it's very difficult to feel the presence in each other because we know each other too well. Oh, I know this person. Yeah, he's, you know, it's okay. Yeah, this person may be Brahman deep down underneath it all, but but you have Sri Ramakrishna, you have Jesus, you have Buddha, you have Krishna, Rama. There you're full of love, full of beauty. I mean, there you can just melt down in devotion. You know, this is the visible Brahman. This is, and then Sri Ramakrishna, it pervades the whole of reality, pervades you, each one of us through and through. All these divine beings, they come with that message, they come with that reality, and then they themselves for each one of us who follows them, they become the doorway. See, Sri Ramakrishna talked about what is the incarnation? There's an infinite wall in a field, and there's a hole in the wall. And through that hole, you can see what's on the other side. So that is the function of the divine incarnation. That's the function of God come down to this earth to be that hole. And there we can, I mean, it's very difficult to find Brahman in ordinary things and ordinary experiences. But if you have someone who is worshipped like this, who is has been so full of sweetness in his own life on earth, through that everything becomes real, everything becomes so tangible. So by, absorption in these great souls, we get a taste of that. That's our entrance to it. That's how we get into this conception. That's how we get access to this wonderful realm of light in which they dwell eternally and to which they also give us access. So thank you.